Chemical Watch podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's news podcast, hosted by members of the Chemical Watch team. I'm Kate Lowe, Global Managing Editor at Chemical Watch, and for today's episode, I'm joined by our science editor, Andrew Turley, business editor, Lee Stringer, and Asia desk editor, David McFarlane. The subjects we'll be discussing today include a suggestion from the European Commission to incorporate Canadian criteria for the identification of polymers of low concern in a framework for registering polymers developed by consultants Wood and Peter Fisk Associates on behalf of the Commission. We'll also be catching up with latest developments in China, including publication of the final administrative measures for registering and filing cosmetics under the overarching Cosmetics Supervision and Administration Regulation, which came into force on the 1st of January. Also, a likely change of name for China's incoming overarching chemicals law. But first, we'll start with the decision of global restaurant chain McDonald's to phase out the use of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, from its customer packaging by 2025. The fast food retailer's pledge follows hard on the heels of a move last month by fellow retail giant Amazon to ban various substances, including PFAS, from food contact materials used for its own brand kitchen products. And prior to McDonald's and Amazon's moves, at least another 10 US fast food or grocery chains had committed to or already begun phasing PFAS out of at least some of their food packaging. So Lee, can you start by telling us more about the detail of this latest pledge by McDonald's? Which products does it cover and how does it expect to achieve its goal?
Yes, thanks, Kate. So firstly, just to explain a little about the use of PFAS in this industry. They're obviously a chemical group that's widely used in many consumer products, but in this industry, they have greaseproof, waterproof, and they give non-stick properties to food packaging, containers, and cookware. And they're often referred to as forever chemicals because of their persistence in the environment. And because of this, we're seeing governments around the world taking regulatory action, including the US and some US states. So it's certainly one of the most topical substance groups we're seeing at the moment. On to McDonald's. Well, its commitment covers products that are used to package customers food on premises at McDonald's restaurants, and this includes containers, cups, wraps, bags for food, beverages, napkins, and cup carriers. However, it did say that the goal excludes food packaged off-site, wood, and limited locally sourced items. In terms of how it plans to do this, it did give us a little bit of detail. It says that it's going to work alongside its packaging suppliers to ensure that package testing is conducted using the standard protocols for the presence of fluorine, which you can then identify PFASs, and working through a holistic process to ensure that it's using safe compounds. It gave us a little bit more about this holistic process, and it includes assessing the company's packaging and tracking emerging issues. And the work is led by an internal cross-functional group called the Anticipatory Issues Management Team. And AIM is composed of 70 subject matter experts, including supplier partners from around the world. And following the findings of the AIM process, packaging and chemicals go through McDonald's Material Transparency Stewardship Program. And this involves an assessment of the chemical composition of all packaging and evaluating against regulatory compliance, human health, and environmental impacts. So that's a little bit about how they plan to achieve this goal.
Okay, thanks very much, Lee. As we noted earlier, McDonald's is not the only food retailer to have taken action on PFAS. So in December, Amazon took similar steps. And over the past 18 months, others, including Taco Bell, Sweetgreen, Trader Joe's, and others, you know, have moved away from the use of PFAS. So why has McDonald's now decided it's time for them to take action?
Yes, it's a good question, Kay, and we did put it to them. And the food chain announced that this goal is part of its continuous monitoring, testing and innovating on all packaging materials in partnership with its suppliers to ensure they're safe for customers and the environment. So it's a kind of evolution of that work, they were saying. It added that the packaging industry is faced with challenges of identifying viable alternatives for packaging and the availability of supply of alternatives. So again, it says that it's kind of a continuation of what it's already doing. It told us that the 2025 deadline was set to take account of its phased approach, it said, to working with the packaging supply chain and its capacities for new packaging solutions globally. But interestingly, the pledge comes weeks after US NGOs and campaign groups urged the food chain CEO to adopt a public policy to expeditiously ban PFASs from all the company's food packaging and food contact materials that the NGOs said contain PFAS substances in the US and globally. Just a quick note on that, we did report that the NGOs carried out some tests on McDonald's and other food chain retailers' packaging, and they did find levels of fluorine. So it's something that spurred on this effort from the NGOs.
Okay, thanks, Lee. To date, we've talked in terms of a trickle of food businesses in the US moving away from PFAS. Now, with McDonald's and Amazon taking steps in this direction, is this a turning point?
We're definitely seeing a trend here, Kay. You mentioned the list of other food chains that have already taken these steps, and NGOs continue to apply the pressure, especially to those that haven't announced phase out goals yet. However, like many of these trends, regulatory activity is also moving things forward, and specifically in the US, we've seen New York, Washington and Maine pass laws restricting the use of PFASs in food packaging. And it's the timelines that are interesting here, with New York and Washington setting 2022 bans, and the New York law actually goes beyond the measures in Washington and Maine, where their PFAS bans are contingent on states identifying a safer alternative, whereas New York's ban will come in either way. And we put this to McDonald's, and it confirmed that it will always comply with any legislation worldwide with a deadline before 2025, and it will do this through valid chemical testing. But back to your question, it's very much a trend we're seeing, lots of regulations, a lot of focus on PFAS, and a lot of focus on its application in food contact materials.
Okay, thanks very much, Lee. So let's turn now to the latest developments in China, where the final administrative measures for registering and filing cosmetics under the overarching Cosmetics Supervision and Administration Regulation have been published. And a change of name for China's incoming overarching chemicals law is expected. So, David, firstly, can you tell us more about the final administrative measures that have been published and changes that have been introduced in this final version?
Hi, Kate. Of course. So China's National Medical Products Administration, or the NMPA, has published the final administrative measures for registering and filing cosmetics under the overarching Cosmetics Supervision and Administration Regulation, or CSAR, which came into force on the 1st of January. Registration and filing are distinct mechanisms under the CSAR, corresponding to different levels of regulatory scrutiny. Companies must register special use cosmetics and new ingredients, while general use cosmetics and ingredients need only be filed. Special use cosmetics include those with efficacy claims, such as hair dyes, skin whitening, and sunscreens, while general use are those commonly used in hair, skin, and nail care products, perfumes, and makeup. The measures, which were adopted on the 31st of December and published on the 12th of January, will enter into force on the 1st of May. Compared with the draft measures, The final version places greater responsibilities on both domestic companies and Chinese agents appointed by overseas suppliers. The responsible person in China is now accountable for all matters relating to product quality, safety, and efficacy claims.
Okay, thanks very much, David. So can we turn now to China's incoming overarching chemicals framework, which will manage both new and existing chemical substances and sit above the country's revised law on new substances, MEE Order 12, which came into effect on the 1st of January?
Yes, so the law, which is still in draft form, was originally called the Regulation on the Environmental Risk Assessment and Control of Chemical Substances, or ERAC for short. The Ministry of Ecology and Environment published a second draft of the regulation in September 2019. We understand that it is likely to be renamed the Regulations for the Environmental Management of Toxic and Hazardous Substances due to the emphasis on toxic and hazardous substances, although the provision of the proposed law are not expected to change. And at the moment, we are unsure of what the new abbreviation or acronym for the new law will be.
Okay, thanks very much, David. The second draft of the regulation was published in September 2019, but the final version has yet to be published. Are there any indications when we might see this final version?
Not at the moment. The final version has not yet been published, or has it come into force, nor has the government indicated a timeline for the next steps. However, the final version of the legislation will outline the date of its entry into force. Normally, Chinese legislation comes into force either on the same day of its promulgation or several months after that. The latter is usually favoured by industry, as it gives companies some time to digest the new legislation and begin preparing for it. This law could potentially affect all organisations producing, importing, or using chemical substances into the country, as it will overhaul the management of both new and existing chemical substances in China. It is expected that the proposed regulatory framework will be similar to TSCA in the US or Japan's chemical substances control law. It would require pre-market approval of new chemical substances and the evaluation of certain high-risk existing chemical substances.
Okay, thanks again, David. Now, finally, let's turn to moves to regulate polymers in Europe and a suggestion from the European Commission to incorporate Canadian criteria for the identification of polymers of low concern in a framework for registering polymers developed by consultants Wood and Peter Fisk Associates on behalf of the Commission. Now, the Commission is committed to proposing an approach for registering a subset of polymers by the end of 2022. To set a basis for discussion, it commissioned two consultancies, Wood and Peter Fisk Associates, to review the options and develop an initial framework, which they provided in a report published last year. The Wood PFA report said that polymers of low concern should not be identified as polymers requiring registration, but did not explicitly incorporate any existing system for identifying PLCs in its polymers of requiring registration criteria, drawing criticism from industry stakeholders. So, Andrew, can you tell us more about those criticisms?
Hi, Kate. The polymers issue is pretty complicated. I think the general feeling with the Wood PFA framework is that it was a good first start, laying the groundwork and getting the discussion going. But there's still lots of stuff to sort out before we get any kind of formal proposal from the Commission. The framework provides a way of defining PRRs under EU reach. And it does incorporate this separate idea of polymers of low concern, or PLCs, which is used by other regulatory frameworks for prioritization of polymers. Specifically, the consultants do say that there's no intention here to allow PLCs to become subject to registration. That's not what they wanted, but but they don't explicitly tie themselves to any one of the existing frameworks that use a form of the PLC concept. It's not exactly the same across these different jurisdictions. That was a concern for industry stakeholders. They said that they were worried about that. In particular, it created potential for regulatory divergence. And what they'd like to see is the EU REACH framework, if it's going to implement something for registration of polymers, they'd like to see it align with what's already out there as much as possible. I don't think anyone's thinking that, you know, it's going to be exactly the same as what's out there, because you've got different regulatory environments. But as much as possible, they would like to see it align. So it seems that the criticism has been taken to heart by the Commission. And in this background document, which is provided to the Caracal discussion group, and I should say this document is not binding in any way. It's not even a proposal. It's just a part of the discussion. But the Commission provides a revised version of the Wood PFA framework for people to think about and discuss. And specifically, it's changed a key flowchart for determining PRRs. Right at the top of that flowchart, the Commission has added this new step, filtering out PLCs according to the Canadian framework.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. So can you tell us a little bit more about the Canadian approach to this problem and how the Commission proposes to apply it and how this answers the critics?
Yeah, I've had a quick look at the Canadian framework. There's actually nothing in the document, which is very short, it's only 4 pages long, nothing to link the text to a specific Canadian document. There aren't any references, but I think it's fairly certain that it's talking about a screening assessment published by the government in 2018, where it was carried out under the Chemicals Management Plan, which is this very comprehensive exercise to assess every chemical substance in commerce. That plan is unique to Canada. No one else is dealing with chemicals or has dealt with chemicals in quite the same way. And as I say, the Canadians looked at polymers back in 2018 and implemented criteria for PLCs based on a previous guidance document published in 2005. That's what I think they're referring to. Those criteria relate primarily to a number average molecular weight greater than 10,000 Daltons. So the number is likely to be debated. Or rather, what I mean, the size of that figure, Daltons is a unit of measurement for the size of a molecule or mass of a molecule. So if the mass is very big, the molecular weight is high, the assumption is that it won't be of concern. This is a very common idea when dealing with risk assessment of polymers, but they won't be of concern because it's unlikely to pass through biological membranes like the skin or the lining of the gut. There's some additional bits of detail relating to specific functional groups, but as I say, it looks like primarily the Canadian system hinges on molecular size, which isn't different from the other systems and isn't indeed different from how the Wood PFA framework functions. That's still got this molecular size component. We don't know much more than that at the moment. We're expecting documents from stakeholders commenting on the Commission document to start coming in soon, and I expect there'll be a lot of requests for more clarity. For instance, I don't know why particularly the Canadian framework rather than the ones used elsewhere. There's probably a good reason, but we just don't have that detail yet.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. So what happens next in this process to establish polymer registration in Europe?
Yeah, as I said, the next step is commenting on this. There are a lot of stakeholders who are following this very closely. It's important to note the Commission document includes quite a lot of changes. The PLC one that we've just discussed seems like a particularly important one, given industry comments, but it's not the only one. For example, NGOs are still pushing the idea of some kind of universal pre-registration phase for polymers. Their argument is that that's the only reasonable way to start the process, given that there's such a paucity of information about the polymers that are actually on the market. It's interesting that in this commission document, there's another change to make it necessary for companies to, when they find they have a polymer that doesn't have to be registered, necessary to share their justification with ECHA in documented form. That is perhaps an attempt to find a kind of middle ground between a universal pre-registration phase and no obligations at all for polymers that aren't PRRs. So it'll be interesting to see if that placates the NGOs on that particular front. There's also a ton of changes relating to quite technical aspects of polymers, which are, as we know, this fantastically diverse class of chemicals that are in some ways quite fundamentally different from other classes of chemicals. So loads of detail. There's a dedicated subgroup for this polymers discussion at Caracal. It's called CASC polymers. And we understand that it's going to meet again at the end of this month. So more information then, hopefully longer term. As you say, the commission has to propose an approach for registering a substance of polymers by the end of 2022.
Thanks again, Andrew. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you again to Andrew, David, and Lee for sharing their insight into today's stories with us. And thank you to you, our audience, for listening to today's episode. If you would like to find out more about the topics from today's discussion, please head over to the Chemical Watch website at chemicalwatch.com. Until next week, goodbye.
The Chemical Watch podcast.